Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey everyone, it's Healthy Gut Girl. This is Kitty Martone coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine. This is stuff your doctor should know. And today's guest has some pretty shocking things to share with us. I love this guest. She has her own podcast called Revolutionary Health. And I think you should check it out. She's incredibly smart. I'm telling you, she makes me nervous. She's so smart. But she's awesome. She's adorable. She has a great Instagram. You want to learn a lot of things every week, just watch her Instagram and you will learn so much. She's got a lot of information to share with you that is going to help you improve the quality of your life. So please welcome Stephanie Center. This has been coming up a lot lately with in my estrogen dominance support group. We have been talking about progesterone and how it works so differently in different women, and how absorption is really peculiar from person to person, and how some women need much higher doses, like mega doses, and how some women just barely need, 3 milligrams sometimes rubbed on the gums, and they have this like dramatic experience with, symptoms going away and whatnot. And I had Carol Peterson, the pharmacist, on my show, and she said that endocrine disruptors are highly overlooked, and that xenoestrogens are highly overlooked when it comes to hormone levels, and that she believes that these xenoestrogens can occupy receptors and actually make it very difficult, get in the way of absorption. But there really was no study data on that. But she really suspects that xenoestrogens are the most overlooked. And you have some very interesting information for to share with us today that I can't wait to dig into in regards to one of the most pervasive and prevalent estrogen, xenoestrogens out there. And that's what comes in the form of pesticides, right?
Yeah. Well, that's a perfect, I love that episode, by the way.
Awesome.
I didn't realize before listening to that episode that the Dutch cannot differentiate between xeno and real, like you're just seeing an estrogen level. So you have to kind of guess how it got there. But one, to kind of relate this idea of xenoestrogens and glyphosate, which is in the weed killer roundup. That's what I'm here to talk about today. Mm-hmm. The idea there is xenoestrogens mimic the role of estrogen in your body, right? And so there's this idea of a hormone mimicry happening. And I believe that glyphosate, because it's a glycine-based molecule, can perform molecular mimicry in the form of glycine. Specifically, when you are looking at an amino acid analog where a glycine is to the right of an alanine, because that allows for some extra. If you look at that amino acid analog, there's some extra space in there. And glyphosate is a glycine molecule with this this extra methyl phosphonyl group. Stephanie Seneff calls it a nitrogen wart. I like that phrasing. It's easy for me to remember.
Okay.
And it kind of fits into that sequence. And so the question is, can glyphosate potentially mimic the role of glycine? And that's, if you're listening and you're like, what's a glycine? It's your smallest amino acid. So it's everywhere. Can it potentially mimic that molecule? And if the answer is yes, then what is it doing in our bodies? And maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. That's just one way that I think glyphosate can disrupt our bodies. We were to zoom in at the, I think in order to know where you're going, you need to know where you came from. Mm-hmm. And just for listeners who aren't, you're not familiar with me, most likely, I'm not a famous person. How do you get into studying glyphosate? It's not like you just wake up one morning and go, you know what? I think I'm going to research weed killers today. So I'll just say for my background, how I got into looking at glyphosate is I was working as an occupational therapist in acute care, so in the hospital setting. And I was doing clinical research. We were trying to get Joint Commission accreditation for some things like spine and joint units. So I was taking a lot of data on patients. And I saw a lot of young people getting total joint replacements and spine surgeries. And so I started to go, well, why is this happening? And three kind of common denominators that I found amongst this group of my, you know, my sample size, and this is a clinical sample size. This isn't a research sample size. You know, I'm selecting from my location here in Nashville, Tennessee. But the three things I found in common for these young folks were Hashimoto's, hypothyroiditis. So hypothyroidism, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and type 2 diabetes. And that's what led me to start asking questions about the environment, because those are all three of those are issues of environment. You know, they're not issues with our DNA. So that's how I started studying different things. And I kind of landed on glyphosate. Now, the history of glyphosate, I think, is really important. If you're wanting to understand how glyphosate can impact your body, I think you have to know what it is. So glyphosate came out in the 1960s. It was created by the Stouffer Chemical Company, and it was patented as a chemical chelator. And why that's important is because it chelates metals, and we have metals in our body. So is that potentially playing a role in some diseases? I would say probably. I think there's some sufficient evidence, and I'm happy to share any and all research articles I have. Some of them you have to pay for, but I'm happy to share those links with you and your audience.
Right.
But so it started as a chemical chelator. And I think that's really important to know.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
But not a chemical chelator for human beings, or was it to actually like strip metal off of things?
Great question. It was a pipe cleaner.
Okay.
Started out as a pipe cleaner. Yep.
Wow. Okay. So that gives us a real clear perspective about, oh boy, that should we be ingesting this at all?
Right. Because we have a really important metals in our body that we actually need. I think we sometimes will focus on heavy metals, which can be bad for us. But we have other metals that are really important. So anyways.
Well, like magnesium, isn't magnesium? I mean, aren't a lot of our minerals really a type of metal? Like I heard that, I was like, wait a minute, what?
I mean, if you listen to Morley Robbins, he talks a lot about copper.
Yeah. And how good it is and how it is a metal. Yeah. Magnesium is not, though, is it?
Magnesium's a mineral. Maybe you're thinking manganese. That's manganese. A metal.
I thought I heard someone like Dr. Selig refer to a handful of them as metals and like calcium even. But yeah, okay. So minerals, metals, got it. But still, I really didn't realize that. I didn't think of them in terms of like, oh, I'm getting copper from this beef liver and it's a metal. It's wild to think of it like that. Okay, carry on.
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting, so, autism is a hot topic right now. And, children with autism, if you look at kind of, unfortunately, postmortem studies, they have excess glutamate in their brains. And what is responsible for glutamate synthetase? Manganese, which is a metal. Is there a connection there? I think that's worth exploring. Certainly our genes haven't changed over the last 50 years, but the prevalence of autism sure has.
Yeah.
And I know that that's multifactorial. There's not like one smoking gun there, but just interesting questions to ask.
Yeah. Which we should be allowed to ask.
We should be allowed to ask. Yeah. That's the whole reason why I do what I do. Cause you should be allowed to be curious. Okay, so we established in the early 1960s. I think the patent was awarded around like 1964. Maybe they applied in 1961 or so. Those dates don't matter. Then in 1969, Monsanto received the patent as an herbicide. And the reason that it was approved as an herbicide, so that means we spray it on our weeds to kill weeds, spray it on our produce to kill weeds. The reason it was approved for use and deemed as safe is because it attacks what's called the shikimate pathway in plant cells. And humans don't have shikimate pathways in their cells, so it's not dangerous for us, right? This is before we knew what the microbiome was. Okay. And it turns out our good gut microbes have shikimate pathways. So it's
really
disturbing to our gut, our ecosystem in our gut. And part of the reason why we have so much gut dysfunction today, I feel like everybody has a digestive issue. So again, I'll just preface with, in research, correlation does not imply causation, right? We all know that. But when there's smoke, there's fire. So you need to look where the smoke is. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what I'm trying to do here is look at where's the smoke coming from? Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's a really, and Zach Bush does a lot of great research on this topic of how glyphosate can disrupt the microbiome. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend his work for that. And we know a lot of autoimmune diseases are gut related.
Mm-hmm. They introduced it as a metal chelator pipe cleaner. Mm-hmm. And then Monsanto said, hey, this stuff really kills weeds. It's great. Let's make it a weed killer. Oh, and weeds are with food and in produce, it kills the weed. Does it also kill insects? Is glyphosate for insects or is that an entirely different insecticide?
Right. It's not a pesticide to my knowledge. It's okay. Just an herbicide.
So then this herbicide, they just start selling it to everybody, including domestic households. Mm-hmm. And people are spraying it on their tomatoes and everything. And to keep the weeds from, taking over. And then they're spraying it on in places like where they're highly producing soy and corn and just about everything. And so now around what year did it start really just saturating all of our food? Do you know?
I love this question. Yes. So we started using glyphosate commercially around like 1971. But if you want to look at the usage of glyphosate over time, I think I actually have a post on Instagram with a timeline of our usage over time. Mm-hmm. But if you want to see a big jump, 1996 is when GMOs came out, genetically modified organisms, mm-hmm. also known as Roundup Ready crops. That's when our usage just really amplified. And what's interesting about that, if you're listening and maybe you're an 80s baby or a 90s baby. I'm from the 80s. I got to bring peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to lunch. Mm-hmm. We didn't have celiac disease. What's that? That wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
We didn't have gluten-free anything. We didn't have an organic section. I didn't have to worry about that. My sister, fast forward, she was born in 1996. Not only did she suffer from a lot of gut issues that I never had, but all of her friends had peanut allergies and gluten sensitivities. And what's interesting about that, a connection to make there, our commercial wheat is sprayed with glyphosate. We spray it as a desiccant to dry it out so we can harvest it faster. And then peanuts are one of the most highly sprayed crops in the United States as well. And I think people have this false idea that because peanuts are in a shell, they're protected. Mm-hmm. But you have to remember that glyphosate works on the soil level. It's trying to kill the weeds in the soil. So it's killing everything else in the soil too. Mm-hmm. And those peanuts are growing from that soil. They're not, the shell isn't protecting them from anything. Mm.
Same with almost all produce, right? Anything like watermelon that seems so durable, but it's those vines and that get into the soil that uptake the nutrients that come along with the glyphosate and all whatever else they're doing. So that's how quickly it increased in 96. And as soon as that, just a few years later, your sister is a little older and all of a sudden, she's just a toddler and starting to present probably with all kinds of like ear, nose and throat stuff and colic, maybe your gut stuff. And then, mm-hmm. that is terrifying really. So can we see that elevation in how sick people got, how sick children got?
You can. Yeah. The 90s were a big decade to see. There's some other things that happened in the 90s that probably can't talk about on this podcast, but,
you know,
there
try.
Are other, There are other things that came out in the 90s that I think maybe could possibly contribute to that. But
can I guess, is it, did they increase mm-hmm. the inoculation schedule?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Yeah. And so, and then the genetically modified organisms themselves, right? We just don't really know much about those guys. Or we are starting to know now.
But it's really, yeah, I'm kind of undecided on how I feel about just GMOs. I don't know that they're inherently bad, mm-hmm. But they were created to, you know, resist Roundup. Mm-hmm. So that would be an interesting thing to explore. I can say that they're not as nutrient dense because they're sprayed with glyphosate, but I don't know that they're inherently less nutrient dense.
I guess it would really depend on what they're married with, right? What the DNA mm-hmm. of the potato is. Like if it has spider DNA from it, or it mm-hmm. has some kind of, you know, I don't know, cotton DNA, whatever. It's like, who knows what that's going to do in my yep. gut versus your gut versus a 1960s person's gut, you know, 1960 baby gut. Okay. So let's go back to, the inception of, or not the inception, but when it really took off, and then mm-hmm. how is that going to play out in our endocrine systems in these babies that were born in 96, opposed to us, mm-hmm. like you and then me, I was a 70s baby really. And how, what that did to my gut versus you and then your sister. And I mean, not just our guts, but our endocrine system. Am I jumping ahead?
No. Okay. I think that's a really great question. So I know you're really into hormones. I found this to be interesting. There was a study done on babies, and I don't know who thought to look at this. But one thing that's interesting, so PCOS is on the rise. We see a lot of PCOS. If you subscribe to the idea of molecular mimicry, and I know not everyone does, not everybody believes that you can substitute a glycine for a glycine. Just like there are going to be people out there that don't believe that synthetic hormones are any different from real hormones. Mm-hmm. I believe they're different, but I understand that there are people that don't. So I'll just say, make the assumption you subscribe to molecular mimicry. What's interesting is glyphosate can inhibit the aromatase enzyme, which I think could potentially play a role in PCOS. Yes. Why? Because the aromatase enzyme is responsible for converting testosterone into estrogen. Mm-hmm. So, and you have a higher concentration of testosterone. So they studied infant girls, and they were actually, again, don't know who thought to do this or why, but they were measuring the space from like the vagina to the anus. And that space is longer in people that have PCOS. Hmm. And so that was part of the question, was, is it inhibiting the aromatase enzyme? And that's lengthening the space between those two holes. Hmm. So strange. Yeah, I can send you that one too.
I know, it gets my brain going. It's like a puzzle because you start to figure out, like, because hormones are so fascinating in that way, right? Where, you know, you can't move one and not move the others. It just, that's just the way it is. It's almost like a reciprocity type of thing, mm-hmm. sort of. And I mean, I definitely see a lot of this, these issues with things getting converted to estrogen when they shouldn't be, when you don't want them to be. And, you know, especially as women get into perimenopause, but also, mm-hmm. like you said, PCOS is so much more common than it ever has been. So something is mm-hmm. going on with our endocrine system. So this glycine, I want to understand this more because this is the first time I've ever heard it. Mm-hmm. How is it related to estrogen mimicry? So like when a xenoestrogen comes along, mm-hmm. how is it related to that? Or is there any relation to that?
I think it just depends. Like, amino acids are different from hormones, so uh-huh. but they interact with each other. Mm-hmm. So I think it would depend on like what amino acid sequence is being impacted, and is it in relationship to a hormone?
Okay. So how So with the glycine, you were talking about the children with autism and the glutamate. Mm-hmm. So how, I guess, explain to me how that would look in me. Like it just in a woman who's in perimenopause, almost menopause, and I'm getting this glycine mimicry in my body. How could that present itself in my health or in my hormones or in my gut? Mm. How would it look? What are the side effects to this mimicry?
Well, I think.
Why should we care?
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the best way to explain this. I think I love functional medicine. Mm-hmm. I think that sometimes maybe an area of opportunity for functional medicine or kind of a limitation is this idea of one root cause. Like mm-hmm. we're just looking for one root cause when sometimes things are the result of a perfect storm. Yeah. And I think that maybe this is an example of a perfect storm. Okay. I think that, for instance, like there are different autoimmune conditions that are related to our hormones. Mm-hmm. And one idea is we know that glyphosate contributes to leaky gut or intestinal permeability, however you want to describe that. Mm-hmm. And we know that when our contents that are supposed to be in our intestines, when they leak into our bloodstream, it activates our immune system. And that's one way we can develop autoimmune diseases. It's the body attacking itself. Mm-hmm. And I think that there could be a relationship there between different hormone-related autoimmune conditions, mm-hmm. like Hashimoto's, like hypothyroidism. Mm-hmm. But how did that person get there? How did they get to that position? And I think to answer that question, that requires testing, mm-hmm. to figure out like, how did you get here? It requires a conversation with that person and their lifestyle. It's really hard for, I think that it's just not a one size fits all. So I think I have trouble answering that.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm probably, sometimes I want, because my brain, I don't come from a scientific background. I came to this, my profession by way of me being ill and then mm-hmm. falling down the rabbit hole of figuring these sure. things out and trying to digest them as a layman or as a layperson. And so I know that is the attraction to my podcast for a lot of my peeps, because yeah. they're like, well, break that down even more for me so I can yes. really understand, So that's why I'm picking at it. It's the first I've heard of it. So it's fascinating to me.
Yeah. I would recommend, Stephanie Seneff's book, Toxic Legacy. Okay. Her book is very technical. Mm-hmm. So it's not written in like layperson language, but she does break down like what amino acids look like. Mm-hmm. And if you're listening, if you want to Google like what a glycine molecule is and what a glyphosate molecule is, maybe that could help give you a visual okay. of how similar they are. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at sequences, but this is the nitty gritty. I mean, amino acid analog, those are tiny little,
it's what proteins, the building blocks of protein. So this right. can have an effect on our most basic molecular level, right? Just so it can probably affect every level of growth and every level of, like you were saying, leaky gut and permeability of the intestines. And so it's super scary sounding. I mean, molecular mimicry, that sounds scary.
Well, so I think I thought of a way to explain this. So okay. if you're listening and you're concerned about hormones, mm-hmm. think about what it takes to make a hormone. It takes enzymes. And what does it take to make enzymes? It takes minerals. And so we're talking about the basic building blocks of your hormones. We're not talking about, to me, hormones is like kind of like a bigger picture. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the teeny tiny steps it takes to get to making a hormone. So how can it affect your hormones? In so many ways.
Right.
In so many ways, because it's what we're looking at is teeny tiny compared to a hormone.
The big hormone, right. And then, so we're talking about glyphosate disrupting human physiology at the building blocks of yes. proteins. And that is, can have a cascade of effects down the line to gut health, hormones, mineral Absolutely. Balance, brain function, cognition, nervous system stuff. So it's a huge fat deal.
That's why I care about it so much.
Yeah. Well, because, it's a good mission. It's a good passion.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I wanted to briefly interrupt and remind you about Just Thrive spore-based probiotics, and I wanted you to listen to a quick clip of Kiran Krishnan, the celebrity microbiologist, talking about how important a diverse microbiome is and spore-based probiotics.
And the biggest issue with the allergies and all the crazy sensitivities, when you look at the prevalence rate of peanut allergies and environmental allergens, and the fact that asthma is now among kids is a pandemic, you know, all of these things are because of the loss of oral tolerance. The loss of oral tolerance means that what we used to be able to do is take in huge amounts of different, you know, proteins and antigens and things that, that people would now be allergic to. The immune system would be able to sample it. The bacteria within your gut would be there to help the immune system figure out, this is something you need to attack and this is something you need to leave alone. That's the process of immune tutoring. And that is lost when we lose the diversity in our microbiome.
Thanks for listening to Kiran Krishnan. If you want to use your coupon code HGG20 to get 20% off, just go to justthrivehealth.com and check out all the great things they have. And now back to the show.
So should we steer it over to liver toxicity? Like, how does this relate?
Well, so, okay. I want to just really quickly say the third. So glyphosate has three different patents. Okay. So in the around 1964, don't quote me on that date exact. Chemical chelator around 1969, we had herbicide. In 2003, can you guess what it was patented as?
Wait, is this the antibiotic?
Yes.
I
2003.
I mean, okay. It was patented as that. Yes. I thought they just classified it as, because I'm going to let you take this. I don't want to ruin it.
No worries.
I don't think I understand it. Go ahead.
Well, so back to the idea of it working as an herbicide because it attacks the shikimate pathways in our plant cells. We know that our gut microbes have shikimate pathways. It's an antibiotic. It kills them. So instead of, it was kind of a smart move on their part. Instead of saying, ooh, this is really bad, it's like killing our gut microbiome, they're going, oh, this is great. And now it's an antibiotic.
Oof.
You know, wow. That's the way I take it in the literature. I know I'm biased when I read that.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess from their perspective, it's like, wow, this can be, so are they prescribing it, using it in a clinical setting or as a treatment, or they just classify, they just patented it that way because they can classify it as a life.
Yeah. And so why not patent it? Cause then you can use it in the future. If you want to, you've got a patent.
That's just bizarre. I remember when I heard it, it was a while ago, and they said someone had probably, like, Organic Consumer Facebook site or something said that one bowl of Cheerios is like the equivalent of like taking a round of penicillin or something. And I mean, I don't know how scientific that is, but you get the point. It's like, oh, this can really decimate some of my microbiome, some of my good bacteria, my good microbes. That's really disturbing.
Oh my gosh. And I grew up on Cheerios.
They're so good. And the Honey Nut Cheerios.
You know, what's sad is one year for Halloween, I think this was like middle school or something, my school costume was Cheerios. And it was like, I lowered my cholesterol today. And like, looking back at that, it's like, oh my gosh, like, what terrible information I was fed and then advertised to other.
Okay. You're going to laugh right now. And this is a confession. So bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I actually was a commercial actress. That's why I moved to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest spots I ever booked was for Honey Nut Cheerios. And I said the tagline in an elevator to the people in the elevator. I like look around and I'm smiling and they're looking at me like, why is she smiling? And I go, I lowered my cholesterol. Woo! I did. And I got paid a lot of money for that. Oh my gosh. This is just, forgive me.
We didn't know back then.
We didn't know.
We didn't know what we know now.
It's funny because I have high cholesterol now. Oh my goodness.
Perhaps it's from the Cheerios. No,
yeah, really. Wow. Okay. So this is fascinating and I'm glad you combed that out for us. So So what's next then? What does that do?
What do we do? Yeah. So now that we know how it works, what do we do about it? Mm-hmm. And to answer, I'll just kind of give like a 30,000 foot view for the liver health.
Okay.
Because non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is one of the things that led me to glyphosate, because I kept seeing it over and over again. And honestly, in OT school, I didn't even know what that was.
Wow.
We learned about alcoholic cirrhosis of the liver. We learned about NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, NAFLD. That, like, I had to look that up the first time I saw it. I didn't know what it was. Because it wasn't as big of a problem as it is now. Which if you're into stats and numbers, this will blow your mind. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is predicted to be the leading cause of a liver transplant by 2028, which is not far away.
Wow.
So we're going to need a lot of livers.
That's disturbing.
And why, I mean, our food system in general is the reason why our livers are so clogged, and the fact that we introduce new chemicals every year that are not being regulated. Dr. Ailey Cohen, she has a book called Non-Toxic Guide to Living in a Chemical World, which I highly recommend. She talks about, I actually interviewed her when that book released. She works underneath, it's part of, oh my gosh, what's his name? Dr. Wheels, Healthy Living Guides.
Okay.
He's been on Ellen. He's like a big
Dr. Wheel. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a big deal.
He looks like Santa, right? That's the one.
He does look like Santa.
He was probably like the first, I mean, yeah, I think it's like the first real commercial nutrition guy that kind of brought the wellness movement into light. I remember, because when I started nutrition school, I had to read a bunch of his stuff. And I was like, oh, I even had like a series of CDs that I had to listen to. Remember those? Of CDs I had to listen to. I was like, oh, I like this guy. Yeah. Anyway. Okay.
Yeah. So she's got a great book that kind of talks about the chemicals that are like, I think, oh, don't quote me on this because I don't have my notes in front of me, but somewhere around like 9,000 chemicals are created every year, and they're not being monitored or they're not being regulated, rather. And so we just have a lot more exposure to toxins in general. Glyphosate's one of them, but it's really hard to, in my opinion, it's really hard to isolate that one when there are so many other contributing factors. But one connection you can make to liver health is glyphosate is really good at stripping the mineral sulfur from our soil.
Oh.
And sulfur plays a really big role in liver detoxification, right? Your phase one liver detox is what? Sulfation.
Right. It makes me think, it makes me think of DHES, right? That's a sulfation process, isn't it? And then how that affects androgens and how that affects PCOS as well. So we're back around to that again.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. So that's one of the questions that I ask, you know, if you're looking at somebody's Dutch and their DHEA sulfate is low, but maybe their testosterone is high, or, you know, or vice versa, if their DHEAS is high, because that's the parent hormone to testosterone, right? Mm-hmm. And so you would think they would be on the same page. You would think that, and I'm pleased, like, I know we're talking about glyphosate. I recognize there are other things that contribute to those numbers being off and people having different experiences. But for the sake of our conversation, like, I wonder what role glyphosate could be playing in that.
Yeah, sure. Wow, that's so interesting. Okay. And then, you know, I just thinking about this study, I was trying to find it there for a second, about reducing, they took, you probably know it, I'm sure, that they had, I think it was in Sweden or something, where they had people who were eating commercially grown produce stop, and they were testing their urine. And after 10 days, how dramatically the levels dropped in their urine that quickly, just by switching to organic in a matter, I think it was 10 days. Do you know the study I'm talking about?
No.
I'll find it later.
And levels of what in their urine?
The levels of a pesticide residue, I guess. Or I don't know if it was glyphosate in particular. That's what I was trying to figure it out. But it was like pesticide residue showing up in their urine. And that after like 10 days, it was just this dramatic decline just from switching to eating organic food. So, but anyway, that was just my thought, because we were going to start talking about the liver and what can we do.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, what's another, so if you're listening and you're like, yeah, what do I do? One thing that I think that's really important to know about glyphosate is, so we operate in a world of, if you're in medicine, it's called lowest effective dose, right? You're not going to give somebody more pain medication than what's absolutely necessary because you could hurt them, mm-hmm. right? Or so we have this idea of lowest effective dose. In research, the term is called NOAEL, N-O-A-E-L, no observed adverse event level.
Okay.
Both of those ideologies are derived from the idea that dose makes the poison. And here's what I want to say about glyphosate. Dose does not make the poison.
Hmm.
And so, and there were two studies that came out around 2019. The one that's coming to mind, and I'm sorry, I'm like throwing these off the top of my head.
Oh, I love it.
I have a lot of them memorized.
I love it.
It was out of Washington State. What was really fascinating about that study, they did three generations. So first generation rats were given glyphosate. Second and third had zero exposure to glyphosate. And guess what? The second and third generations have the poorest outcome. So not the initial rats, not grandma rats that were exposed. And we kind of saw this with, was it DDT back in the 60s?
Mm-hmm.
If you read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, mm-hmm. it was the offspring of the people that were exposed to that chemical.
Yes.
That had all these abnormalities. So similar thing here. A little more insidious because again, we're mimicking a glycine molecule, which is all over our body, can do so many things.
Wow.
And so the second generation, rat babies were born stillborn. And then third generation, you were seeing obesity and chronic kidney disease. And again, this is off the top of my head. I'll send the studies in the link. Really interesting that. Because what is the EPA doing? The EPA is saying, okay, what is your recommended daily allowance? Like what, how much exposure can you have to this and it's not going to hurt you?
Mm.
Well, that assumes that dose makes the poison.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would advocate that no exposure is the only acceptable amount because dose does not make the poison. I think that was made pretty clear in 2019. And the good news is, and I'm so glad we're meeting now instead of mm-hmm. when we originally wanted to meet, because in June of 2022, the EPA decided, we did not assess this properly. And so they're looking at that again. They're looking at, mm-hmm, they're reevaluating. That happened, I want to say, on June 18th in California. So we'll see what the results of that are. But they're saying that they did not adequately assess the carcinogenic properties of glyphosate. So this is specifically, I think, related to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So we could see some changes in the near future. But if you're listening, I would caution you to think, okay, if we get rid of glyphosate, you have to ask yourself, what are they replacing it with?
Yeah.
Because you know Bayer, so Bayer owns glyphosate now. I didn't mention that. In 2016, Bayer bought glyphosate from Monsanto.
Okay.
So Bayer is the pharmaceutical company. I think they're really popular for coming up with aspirin.
Mm-hmm.
So big pharmaceutical company. They don't care about your health.
Right.
They're going to just try to make money. And so they're coming up with something else. And I think the product that we'll see on the shelves in the future is a product called Liberty Link. And instead of being a glycine base, it's going to be a glutamate base.
Oh boy.
So back to the idea of your liver health, what are the three things you need to make glutathione? And if you're listening, glutathione is this powerhouse antioxidant. You need a glycine molecule, you need a cysteine, and you need a glutamate. Well, guess what, folks? We just killed two of those between these two products. And the study you mentioned in Sweden, that's a question that I have is, how long does it take to get glyphosate out of your body? I don't know the answer to that. Is there a way to detox glyphosate out of your body? I don't have an answer to that either.
Right.
I'll
have to find that study. And because I just wonder if it's just continual consumption is just going to saturate your tissues or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then as you stop it and then your body excretes it, but who is that? And do they excrete the same way the next person excretes? Like, is that somewhat like, it just seems my concern about stopping the glyphosate is how do you backpedal all of that? Like, isn't it already in our water system? Even if you're buying organic food, isn't it? I think they did a study on all the wines grown in California, even the organic ones, and all of them had pesticide levels in them. So I just don't know how you would backpedal. It's almost like, okay, we did enough damage with this guy. Let's introduce another one. And I mean, it just doesn't, you know, that's the thing with America as well. And there's other countries that are similar where all of these chemicals are innocent until proven guilty. Whereas in places like Germany and a few other, like probably Sweden, where they're like, no, they're guilty until proven innocent. You have to prove to us that this is not going to kill us or make us destroy our guts. And that's just not how we work here, is it? We just have been so profit driven.
We have 4% of the world's population in the United States, and we use 20% of the world's produced glyphosate.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds a lot like our prescription medication thing as well.
I know. We're one of two countries that allows pharmaceutical companies to market directly to consumer. The other country's New Zealand.
I didn't know New Zealand did.
Yeah. You can't. I have on my social media account a list of all of the countries that have either banned or really restricted the use of glyphosate in their country. And like, really, I feel like we're the only ones left.
Yeah. Wow.
It's just pages and pages. So I think that could explain why, if you're listening, if you've gone to, you know, Italy on vacation and you can eat the bread just fine, but here in the United States, you are gluten-free. I think that could be an explanation why that you don't have a gluten problem. You have a glyphosate problem.
Absolutely.
So many
young people that I know that are in their early 20s and not just early 20s. I have a close girlfriend who's just like 10 years younger than me. And so she's in her early 40s, and she was not vaccinated as a child and never has been, ever had anything. She was brought up on a farm, has all of this wonderful, like, you know, this resume of this really healthy upbringing. And she suffers greatly from hormonal issues and from thyroiditis and things. And I know a handful of young people who are the same, who were not vaccinated, who have very, you know, really, really low exposure to, or what they thought was low exposure to, you know, commercially grown produce, et cetera, don't live in big cities, et cetera, like just the perfect resume, and are really suffering with all kinds of gut stuff and all kinds of skin stuff and definitely hypometabolic. And I'm just like, I think it's just permeated our groundwater and our air that it's just, and these new generations having a harder time dealing with it, I guess. And some, I don't know, it's sad.
Yeah, it is sad. There was a study done that looked at glyphosate concentrations in the rainwater in the Mississippi Delta, because that's kind of like Cancer Alley. So they do a lot of research on
really?
That. Well, yeah. And my personal hypothesis is all of the farmers that spray in the Midwest, their water trickles down the Mississippi River. And where does that end? That ends, you know, in the Mississippi Delta. So that's kind of known as Cancer Alley. But I think it was 76% of the rainwater tested positive for glyphosate. So just walking outside in the rain could expose you. And I feel like I'm sounding doom and gloom, and I don't mean to be.
I mean, we're just messengers, you know, but we're going to talk about some really great stuff here in a second, right?
There are things you can do, and living your life not in fear is one of them. Mm-hmm. Our bodies are resilient, and I believe we were fearfully and wonderfully made, and our bodies are capable of healing. And so for me, that's really empowering that.
Yeah.
we can overcome things. I just think we need to, I'm trying to get your buy-in to care about this.
Yeah.
And vote with your dollars and buy organic food, support your local farmers.
Yes.
Because you know, I think you got to speak the language of the pharmaceutical company that owns glyphosate. And what language do they speak? Money. If you stop buying from them, they'll stop trying to sell you stuff.
Yes.
So if we all collectively together decide we're not going to buy Roundup anymore, they'll stop trying to sell it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'll replace it. They'll find something else and put some bells and whistles on it again. And you know, in nefariously, I feel like, get it into the system before we have a chance to really understand it, which is what they did with glyphosate and GMOs. They just kind of like slipped it in on an industrial level. And then it started making its way into our supply chain. And then we're like, oh, we should start testing this. Oh, this is a problem. So it's interesting. What about, okay, so let's talk about our liver some more, especially because the whole hormonal concept and the whole conjugation that happens there. And also, you know, it is a detox organ. So a lot of people get all up in our faces about, what do you mean detox the liver? It detoxes itself. So what do you think about that? It should, right? Unless it's clogged.
When I left the hospital setting, my flagship program that I was so proud of that I had was a liver detox program. And this was a couple years ago. And I learned really quickly that people were not healthy enough to complete my liver detox program.
Oh my.
I assumed that their livers were functioning more optimally than what they were. So that was a really good learning experience for me. Mm. How can you support your liver in detoxification?
Well, tell me more about that program. Is it similar to some stuff you do now, or is it?
I'm a lot more gentle. That was a really potent, program where I just kind of went all in. And now I take a much more gentle approach with people because I realize not everybody lives like me. That was a big learning experience too.
Yeah.
Not everybody filters their water and eats only organic food and does movement every day. You know, I'm an OT. I should know better. I should know to meet people where they're at. So
you get excited. You're like, oh, this is a, you know, I've done similar things to people as well. And
it works. And like, I never want someone to be miserable while they're healing. I never want that. So I always try to be gentle. I'm a big fan of if you're listening and you're like wanting something to do, get a castor oil pack, put that on your liver. That's so good for you. And it feels good and it's calming.
So what about, what nutrients do you really like? Do you agree with them like liposomal glutathions or taurine and things like that? Tudka.
Yeah. So Tudka is going to be stronger than taurine. It's going to be more advanced because taurine is just a mineral. Mm-hmm. I'm really person specific now. Like I do a lot of testing on people to kind of see where they're at. And then I spend a lot of time interviewing on lifestyle and kind of getting an idea of how, like, you know, I never want to give somebody something that they're not going to do.
Right.
And so, you know, yes, there's a fine line between, you know, there is no substitute for hard work, right? There's no substitute for hard work, but at the same time, let's not throw the kitchen sink at you. And I think that's kind of what I did with the liver cleanse is I was throwing the kitchen sink at somebody instead of making them a meal.
Yeah. Right.
So, I think that supporting the liver, obviously our livers, I read somewhere, this was a long time ago, that we are exposed to more toxins in a month than our grandparents were in their lifetime. Whoa. I think that's probably true. I don't remember where I read that.
Makes sense. I mean, you know, I like to always use myself as an example and get a little free counseling out of these episodes. Okay. But also because I know how many of my listeners can relate to my history, my life. I'm just a worrier. And I know just on an emotional level, and a like traditional Chinese medicine style, like it's directly related to, you know, the liver energy. And so that was a real problem growing up because I was always on medications and I was always toxifying my liver. I was always sick. So I was always taking Theraflu and things that just decimated my glutathione. And then when I started to become more aware of taking care of myself, it was almost like, and the birth control pill, by the way, for a very long time. And it was almost like it was so damaging to my liver that even when I started doing all my gut health, the education, the, you know, the application, it still seems like it's my weak spot. It still seems like no matter what I do, it always becomes, it's like my Achilles heel to this day, even with all the knowledge I have. And so what would you say to somebody, and I know it's very individual, but besides castor packs, like, let's start with diet maybe. Like what are the first things that you think of when you think of healing the liver and diet?
A desiccated beef liver. I love that. I think you mentioned that earlier in the.
Yeah. I was saying for copper, right? For bioavailable copper. What about just, real liver? Like just, I'm not real liver, but fresh liver.
Well, I mean, that goes back to the homeopathy perspective of treating like with like. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you're taking desiccated beef liver, or if God bless you, if you can handle real liver, that's the idea, I think, because the cows that you're consuming, their diet is grass. Hopefully you're having grass fed beef liver. Uh-huh. Yes, they're going to breathe in similar environmental toxins that you breathe in, but they're not putting they're not being shampooed with xenoestrogens. They're not putting lotion on. They're not having ice cream cones. Like their diet is really simple. Uh-huh. And so their livers tend to be really clean. So the idea there is to treat an unhealthy liver with a healthy liver. And I think there's some, some merit to that.
Sure.
The nutrients that their liver needs are very similar to the nutrients your liver needs. So supporting that way. I always try to advocate for getting more sulfur in the diet. So foods that are high in sulfur, or even, you know, a lot of women who are estrogen dominant, sulforaphane, right? Mm. So foods that high in sulfur would be, you know, garlic, onions, eggs. You know the smell of sulfur if you're listening. You know, like right. Cheese, some cheeses. And then sulforaphane will be the brassica family. So broccoli sprouts, Brussels sprouts, all of those kinds of vegetables. Epsom salt baths on that same line, that's magnesium sulfate. So there's sulfur in that. That can be helpful, along with magnesium, which I am a big advocate for. I do believe it takes energy to heal. It takes energy to detoxify. And I believe magnesium is a building block for creating ATP, which is energy in our body.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And then, so I have a random question about the Dutch that keeps on poking into my purview as we're talking. I'm like, I'll get to you eventually, but I just can't even like think anymore without asking it. So I studied the Dutch, quite extensively with precision analytical, and, you know, I've been offering it for a while now, and it's a pretty comprehensive test, as you know, because you offer it. And something that I find interesting with it. So say you have almost undetectable levels of, let's say, estrogen and on the Dutch, but yet in the metabolite section, it's showing that you have really high 16-OH, that you're using that 16-OH pathway out of balance. Maybe it's 50% of the pie chart there, right? So that if you're not excreting that much, but it's showing what you are excreting and it's still favoring that pathway. Like, is that something to worry about? Like, do you want to take DIM if you already have extremely low levels, but yet your 16-OH is half of the pie chart? Does that question make sense?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about that case study, you know, the 16-OH pathway is the only non-methylated pathway for metabolizing estrogen, right? 4-OH and 2-OH are both methylated. Mm-hmm. So then I would want to know, does that person have an MTHFR gene mutation? Is that potentially playing a role? What are their B vitamins look like? Do they, because B vitamins are methyl donors to that pathway.
That person happens to be me.
Oh.
But what about if they are an over methylator? So they're not under methylating, they're over methylating, and they have high, not just me. I've seen it, not a lot, but I have seen it. But also just that concept of, okay, just because your levels are super low, but you're still favoring the 16OH, is that still something to be concerned about? Like, would you as the practitioner go, we need to go ahead and work on, because if your estrogen does come up, or whatever estrogen's not showing in your urine that's in your tissues, you must be favoring the 16OH. Is that a good assumption to make?
Is the 4OH in check?
A little bit out in my case, a little bit high, a little bit.
That would give me more pause for concern than the 16.
Okay.
Just me personally.
Mm-hmm.
It's just my own.
Yeah.
If you're a clinician and you're listening, you might think differently.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I just wonder sometimes about giving people things like diendylmethane, which would lower or help convert 16OH to 2OH. But if you're already really low, why would I want to do that? I don't know. It's more and more, like, the longer I do it, the more complex cases pop up where I say, you know, how are we checking for the estrogens in tissues? And, you know, we're not like so it's just pieces to the puzzle, I guess, is all we can really look at it as in the whole picture of trying to evaluate what's going on with someone's hormones.
Well, I want to learn from you how you're titrating progesterone, because I'm really interested in that and using that to support somebody with low estrogen, right? Because I feel like progesterone gets left out. It's always a conversation, all the fame and glory goes to testosterone and estrogen, and people are like, I don't even know what a progesterone is.
Yeah.
And they interact with each other.
And it's still being blamed for a lot of estrogenic reactions when someone takes progesterone, and it's still being called a progestin by a lot of clinicians. And that's really the crime here, you know. But I just read an article that someone posted in the group that was the UK is about to okay HR, over-the-counter HRT, and they're calling HRT estrogen. They're not saying progesterone. They're literally blanket statement, HRT is estrogen, and we're going to offer birth control over the counter, is basically what they're saying.
Synthetic. So a synthetic.
Yeah. So it's probably Premarin, or maybe they're going to also, right. Maybe they're going to also offer just a estrogen, bioidentical, if you will, but still it's without progesterone. So there is a tremendous amount of education that is, and misinformation that is just permeating this field on every level, from the pharmaceutical level to, you know, the clinical level. And it's disturbing. So yeah, we try to use the progesterone. I hate saying self-medicate, but that's basically what we're doing, right? Where we're based on symptoms and as much lab and information as you can get, but really symptoms tell us so much. So, you know, you can have, like I said, non-existent levels of estrogen and take progesterone and have these estrogen kickback symptoms that show that you must have estrogen in your tissues because you're having these estrogenic reactions. So it's pretty complex, but, we try to narrow it down to like decide whether or not you're doing like a maintenance method that a doctor might recommend, like days 14 through 28 or ovulation to bleeding. But if you have PCOS or PMDD, or you have these really severe issues, then you're going to want to do like daily for 3 months and start at a certain dose and titrate up until symptoms go. And then that's the other way of doing it. But that's just the cliff notes, right? Mm-hmm. Because like you said, it's so individual for each person.
Yeah.
And what else are they doing to bring balance?
Oh my gosh. I would love to interview you about that if you would ever be up for it.
Of course. Yeah. I'd like to
put you on the spot.
No, I mean, it's, I do it all day long talking about this whole progesterone thing and trying to help women the way it helps me, you know? But yeah, of course. And we can chat about all of that stuff. But so I just want to thank you so much for giving this time to me. Is there anything else you want to add about your work and about what you offer? Because I know that you coach and,
You know, I hope that this conversation, I hope to accomplish two things. I hope to spark curiosity. Mm-hmm. If you've never heard of glyphosate, maybe this will propel you to start buying organic food or, you know, support a local farmer. That goes such a long way, especially if you're not trying to support big aggie mm-hmm. and you want, you know, to make a ding, supporting a local farmer goes such a long way.
And what do you the think about thing, the, sorry, what do you think about the EWG, the watchdog that does the Dirty Dozen? Like if someone has a big family and yeah. they can't afford to buy organic,
it's a great tool.
Do you like that? Okay.
And that's yeah, I like them for the Dirty Dozen and Clean 15. They're not my favorite for non-toxic product, like cleaning products and skincare and all that stuff, mm-hmm. just because they do have conflicts of interest. They do have relationships with companies.
Really?
But as far as the Dirty Dozen Clean 15, I really like them. And I really like them for checking what's in your local water. You can just put your zip code in their website and they'll tell you what's in your local drinking water.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah. They're cool. really good about that. So I love them for food and water.
Okay.
Yeah. And you can download that list. It's a PDF. I think their 2022 list came out like late May, early June.
Strawberry is still at the top.
Strawberries are still number one. I did just a screenshot of on my phone and I have that with me at the grocery store and I play the game. Okay. If they don't have organic and I have to buy inorganic, can I buy it?
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah. I do the same. I do the same. And I always say to people, you know, who can tolerate fermented vegetables.
Yeah,
you can buy a commercially grown cabbage and carrots, and you can ferment them. And that fermentation process is going to eliminate a tremendous amount of that. How it does it, it's magic. The microbes, I don't know how it does it, but Donna Gates had mm-hmm. studies about it and it's like incredible. And then it increases the nutritional value of those vegetables like 100 times. So, you know, I always say, try to do the organic vegetables, some that you could ferment if you can tolerate ferments. So that's one thing to do.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. Taking your health back by making these, you know, simple decisions.
Yeah.
Think is like if you could just buy one food organic this week that you wouldn't have bought, like that will add up over time, just little baby steps.
Mm-hmm. Your message.
Oh no. I have a podcast called Revolutionary Health. If anyone's interested in listening to that, I do a lot of deep dives. I try really hard to make the information I kind of kid around, like, so Nancy from Missouri can understand.
Yeah, you do a good job. I, you know, cause I think I'm Nancy from Missouri. I mean, I'm not, I'm, you know, Kitty from New Mexico, but I, you know, but I definitely have the only reason that I ever ended up where I'm at is because of my health and I couldn't do it the way I was doing it anymore. So I have that brain where I prefer things to be spelled out for me, but I just put my toe in the water. And then I, like I said, I try to do my best as a layperson. And so I love your show because I feel like you do enough of both. And hey, it entices you, you know, it brings you out of your wanting things to be spoon fed to you, you know, and then you start to open up your purview opens and you start to go, before you know it, a year passes and you're like, wow, I'm eating almost all organic. I know what glyphosate is. I know what glutathione is. And it just is a slow education that can really help, you know?
Yeah. And in my show, my core, like my highest value is curiosity, just being allowed to ask questions, difficult questions. I have, speaking of glyphosate, I have an episode with a traditional medical allergist and immunologist. And I asked him about what he thought about glyphosate, because he treats food allergies all day long. He had never heard of glyphosate. So it's just interesting, you know, the educational differences. And so I try to figure out sometimes like, well, what are doctors learning in school and where are the holes in their education? Right. Cause it's not perfect. I think minerals is a whole. I think they don't learn about minerals, and they don't learn about environmental toxins. They don't learn about nutrition, which is huge. Which that's a big area of opportunity for medical school students. So anyways, I just try to ask those questions and, So that's one way people can, you know, learn more information if this conversation sparks interest. I do share a lot of facts and figures about glyphosate on my social media. If you wanted like little factoids or tidbits, and I always show the address of wherever I got the information from, if somebody wants to read a research article. But I'd also caution you, if you're listening, research is not perfect. It's flawed.
Yes.
So, research, you know, people put research on a pedestal, and I've worked at multiple research labs. I worked at one at the University of Illinois and one at Washington University in St. Louis. They were not perfect. Mm-hmm. And I think once you've worked in research, you can go, okay, well, I think clinical, like personal anecdotes are just as meaningful, like personal clinical, like the cases you talked about today
are
just as important as any research article. So I do encourage people to value both.
I love that you said that, because it's my last episode with Kyle Mamonis. He's doing all this clinical research, and he was talking about the same thing. And he was like, you know, these people who are doing these studies and these journals, they're doing these particular papers, let's say, there's a bias, even if they don't necessarily, they're not aware of it. You know, the worst thing for a student who's trying to do a particular study for their, you know, to get their PhD or whatever, they want to present something and they want the outcome to be a certain way in order so that they can get their PhD. And if it doesn't happen that way, it's like, oh, great. It doesn't look good if you're trying to prove something and then you don't prove it. And so you naturally, even if you're not, you have no intention behind it, but you just have this, I want the study to come out. I hope it comes out this way. So you do have a human bias integrated into that, which is going to make it not perfect, right?
Oh, there's so many layers to that. I'll just say this. When I was at WashU, they had a rule saying any paper or presentation, if you're going to cite resources, they can't be older than 7 years old. And looking back, that was really bad advice, because that promotes this logical fallacy that old research is bad.
Right.
And
that
I would
eliminate more than half of Morley's stuff.
Right. Well,
he's
and
like,
I
would, 1943.
But you know what? The people that were doing research back then, you didn't have to question funding like you do now.
Right.
Well, what pharmaceutical company is funding this study? Who's like, you know, there's a lot of black hats in research now. You gotta be really careful with who's doing what and for what end. I feel personally like some of the older research articles, they were just curious. They just wanted to know.
Yeah.
Now it's like, well, yeah, we have this bias. We need to prove that this is effective. So we're going to do what we can to prove that this is effective and make money off of it.
Yeah. And because whoever the coffee industry is funding this study, and we had better, you know, otherwise we're going to lose the funding.
You got to make people happy, make shareholders happy. I get it. But that really doesn't really advocate for the scientific method, unfortunately.
Yeah. So. Oh, well, humans, right? Humans, we're from the fall, just dealing with it. Yeah. It's a ride it out. Well, I'm so grateful to you. I hope that everybody tunes into your podcast. It's Revolutionary Health, right?
Yes. Yep. With Stephanie and Center. You can just look up my name.
It's all going to be in the show notes. And thank you for all of this. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Amazing. And also daunting, right? Because the idea that we're exposed to all these chemicals, unbeknownst to us, you know, unwillingly exposed to these things, it's daunting. But I thought about this after we recorded. We didn't talk as much about the gut as I maybe should have, but I can mention a few things now. In regards to like how resilient the human body is and how incredibly adaptive our microbiome is. And, you know, when you are supporting your gut health, your body can adapt to these things and start to create more microbes that are designed to kind of get rid of this stuff quicker from our bodies. And we do have microbes that do that. And that's why I really like taking spore-based probiotics, because that is one of the things that Kiran Krishnan, who is the creator of Just Thrive, he actually talks about in one of our episodes. I think it's episode 171, I think, where he talks about how spore-based probiotics can, you know, get into the bowel, and they sort of like sense their microbial environment, and they open up. They're kind of like in a shell, and they open up, and they start to do all kinds of things there, including, you know, getting rid of certain chemicals and toxic elements, toxic particles in the bowel. And that's really cool. And then, of course, I'm always talking about fermented foods, but I haven't talked about it lately as much as I should. But I, you know, I mentioned in the podcast that Donna Gates used to talk about how fermented foods, like you can ferment a commercially grown cabbage, and the pesticides that are in that will add, the microbes that are in the fermentation in the jar that you're making the vegetables in, they can actually break down these chemicals and reduce the amount of toxicity in that cabbage, and increase the nutritional quality, the nutritional value of the product too, like by 100 times. You're getting like 100 times more vitamin C than if it wasn't fermented. Anyway, those are cool facts about our bodies and about ferment, you know, the microbiome, really, about microbes and how incredibly awesome they are. And that we shouldn't feel too daunted about this stuff. You know, she gave us a lot of good information about supporting liver function and, and, you know, talking about supporting gut health. Those things are so important, because even if you eat 100% organic, you know, if you're going out to have food and have dinner, most restaurants do not use organic unless they specifically say so. I mean, I live in LA, and we, you know, there's a huge food scene here, farm to table, blah, blah, blah. And guess what? Most of them do not use organic. It's a lot more expensive, and so they don't use it. So the restaurants that do are going to say that they do. So if you're eating out, you're getting that. And if you're drinking wine, you're getting some level of pesticide residue in your system of glyphosate. So, right. Well, anyway, I hope that was helpful to you. I really think you should reach out to Stephanie Center. She's got this wonderful podcast, Revolutionary Health. She's so educational. She's so helpful and really smart. And you should also check out her Instagram. You're going to learn so much. And all that information is in the show notes. All right.